Declan McGonagall was the first curator of the Orchard Gallery in Derry. During his time as director there, he was nominated for the prestigious Turner Prize. A former director of a series of national art institutions, including the Irish Museum of Modern Art, the Institute of Contemporary Art in London, and the National College of Art and Design in Dublin. Declan has served, and indeed continues to serve, on several advisory panels. He's a contributing editor of Art Forum in New York. In his paper for the symposium, Them Not Us, New Necessities for Art, Citizenship and the State, Declan McGonagall linked the idea of citizenship and the role of state policy to ideas of validation. Validation of art practice and production, validation of distribution and experience, and validation of participation. He invoked us to question our inherited views on many aspects of the arts. He questioned our inherited models of provision and proposed some other ways of thinking about these issues for the future. He advocated for a transformation from an inherited vertical hierarchy into a horizontal and inclusive model. He believes that the ultimate value lies in what art does, what it achieves, rather than what art is. Declan talked about why he thought the Perceptions exhibition was important.
It's hugely important, I think, and it's important on a number of levels. It's important for the individuals who are being given an opportunity to access their own creativity. We have a system, a sort of infrastructure, if you like, culturally here, where it's possible, if you have the means, to access the creativity of others. And I think the shift that has to take place, there has to be an equal emphasis on providing the opportunities for people to access their own creativity. Because my view is that everybody is creative. By being human, your creativity is innate. Now, it will express itself in all sorts of different ways. But what's interesting about the idea of an exhibition format, it both validates the experience of people who are otherwise marginalised and held outside, by whatever definition, be it a question of ability, or economic position or social status and so forth, people who are held outside. Culture and visual art in particular, in terms of my field, is an important dimension which can be occupied by everybody and doesn't have to be classified according to any other rubric other than creative responses to opportunities. And they can take any form. And some of them can be extremely high level from a sort of an aesthetic point of view and a material skills point of view. And others can be very basic and simple. But to my mind, and when discussions come up sometimes about outsider art or other aspects of otherness, there's a debate about quality. And this idea of quality kicks in and the idea that it's not great art. That's actually not the point. It's necessary art. And what you will often find is that people who make work who are defined within our mainstream structures as marginal, or who are actually just marginalised by those mainstream structures, that you will find in discussing their work with them that it's necessary for them to make that work. The thing that gets added on, and what's important about this process, is that what has been added to the production of their work, the realization of their creativity, is that it is starting to be distributed into the mainstream. And there has been for several decades now a growing acknowledgement, both critically and organizationally, of the need to be inclusive. Now, this is also a debate in the socioeconomic field and in the political field, but it is not just playing with words. Too often the word inclusion gets added to something like an adjective without any actual follow-through. The point about making exhibitions like this and the point about creating studios where all kinds of people, all kinds of abilities can have access to their own creativity is that what must be added to that, which is what is happening here, is the mechanism of distribution because that's where the validation takes place. When something is made, that's fine. If it stays in the studio, that's fine as well, if that's what is wanted. But the minute you walk out of the studio, you're in the distribution space. You're in the communication space. And all art worthy of the name is about communication fundamentally. The best in art has always been about communication.
So talk me through then, when we are validating their work, the people in the supported studios who we label as disabled artists, I'm wondering, as I say that, who we are, what gives us the right to be, you know, making the qualitative judgments, but we do. So talk me through what's happening there with us. Like, that's somewhat transformational for us as well, isn't it? Because surely we need to view the work just as work. If we take all these labels of otherness, outsider art, disabled artists off and look at the work, but don't we have all sorts of value judgments in our head even as we're looking at that?
We carry enormous baggage which we've inherited within our socio-economic cultural system. You know, if you like, the Western European social frame, no matter about the changes that are going on now, we are still working through what I would argue are 19th century modes of thought about the value of art, the definition of artist, and the role that art can play in the wider social space. And there was a particular moment at the beginning of the 19th century, late 18th century, early 19th century, when museums as we know them were created. They arose from what was called cabinets of curiosities, which very wealthy people had in their great houses. And some of those very wealthy people donated them then to the state, and the state couldn't quite deal with them, didn't know what to do. That's where the National Gallery came about. The Duke of Devonshire decided to donate works to the state, and they had nowhere to put them. And the National Gallery in London was created because the area around what is now Trafalgar Square was disease-ridden slums, and they had to clear that. And in order to clear that and justify the opening up of the city space, the donation by the Duke of Devonshire and the need to create a major public building beside the square came together, and the National Gallery was created. So there is no such thing as art speaking for itself, because that's the other part of the thinking and the baggage that we carry, that somehow a painting or a sculpture speaks for itself. No art has ever found its audience or found its place in history without having an accompanying text. And I don't mean it can be a literal text in terms of talking about the work, but I mean a framing, a contextualization. Now, what has happened through the 20th century is that what developed through a particular form of institutional practice was the pretense that you could separate art's aesthetic responsibilities from its ethical responsibilities. And ethical responsibilities are about morality. And I think morality is about the interaction between human beings and treating other human beings with respect. And I think what's been going on over the last 30 to 40 years, instigated by feminism in art practice, actually, because feminists decided that the male-dominated structure needed to be challenged. And that took place in film, first of all, and then came into art practice in general. And is still obviously a big debate that's rolling. Made a particular set of arguments that were then picked up generally in the arts, and the dynamics in contemporary art, certainly at the moment, I would argue, and in contemporary understanding of historical art, are to do with the reconnection and the possibility of reconnecting art's aesthetic responsibilities to its ethical responsibilities. Because if you go back before the 18th century, late 18th century, when museum culture that we, as we understand it, was generated. It's no coincidence that at the same point in going into the early 19th century, that industrial capitalism was created, which alienated workers from the value of their work, that you had the development of museums. You also had the colonization of huge areas of the planet by Western European countries, all of whom stole culture from those other cultures and needed museums to house them. You know, the question, the joke in the museum world was, is there anything British in the British Museum? Because it was a treasure house. And it was a treasure house demonstrating the Western Europeans' ability to own the rest of the world and classify it. That coincided with scientific achievements in the Enlightenment, which was also about measuring the world, cataloguing the world. Newtonian physics is about a world and a universe of matter rather than a universe of life. And I think what happened in the end of the 20th century, going into the 21st century, is that those issues of what would the counterpoints be like? How could those be articulated? What has not been said? What has not been allowed to enter that hierarchy of value that has been fed by Enlightenment values in terms of science and economics and so forth, but also cultural values in terms of the separation, as I said, between the aesthetic responsibilities of art. And it's out of that idea that art's only responsibilities are aesthetic comes the idea that, well, the artwork must speak for itself and that you decontextualize it. I would argue the Museum of Modern Art, and this is shown in the development of its history in New York, set up by the Rockefeller family and a group of very wealthy families around that, that its intent was to de-socialize art, to decontextualize art, that what you see is what you get, that art speaks for itself.
That suits the policymakers, though, isn't
right.
It leaves the control with them if art only has an aesthetic.
Absolutely, because you see, behind all of this, I mean, the bottom line for all of these issues, whether it's economic or cultural or social, in relation to abilities and all abilities and who gets classified as disabled and not disabled and so forth, is power. Mm. Who has power? How is it exercised and on whose behalf? And if you actually apply that lens to things, I think the structures become very clear. You start to see the scaffolding that holds in place all the value systems that many of the people who enjoy the effects of power would say are natural. They're not natural, they're constructs. They're cultural constructs. Our economy is a cultural construct because it's based on certain values. And those values we can argue with or argue against and agree with, disagree with, but they're constructs.
Well,
they're man-made.
Something very interesting came up in the publication out of the last exhibition outside in the Art of Inclusion. And it was John McCarrick and Marie Brett, the artist and the art therapist in St. Raphael's in Yall. And it was about discussing with their artists that if their work went on show and they weren't described as disabled artists, then they would be open to whatever criticism came their way, and they needed to prepare themselves for people's reaction. But what was very interesting was that, to me anyway, was that in the, I think it was in the Sirius Art Centre, in the visitor's book afterwards, a couple of people had written, oh, if I'd known that it was...
Yes.
By a disabled artist. So their response would have been tempered, presumably. They might have said something harsh in the book because they either didn't like the work or whatever, and they wouldn't have done that if they knew the person was disabled. Now, there seems to be a lot of stuff bundled up in there for me.
There is, and this is where the mediator of that process, be it a curator or exhibition organizer or therapist or whoever, has to actually handle that very, very carefully. I'll give you an example of a situation. When I was directing IMA, we were loaned a very important collection of outsider art from the UK, and we put a show on showing the work as a collection of outsider art, and had essays about them. We had a conference and so forth about where the value lay in such a process. A very good reaction to it. But what I decided to do then was to, because we had we were building a collection, and we had various loan collections included in our collection exhibitions. So in the West Wing Galleries, we had put on a collection exhibition with a particular theme. So I decided to integrate works from the Outsider Collection, the McKinley Musgrave Outsider Collection, into our collection shows in general, without naming the artists as outsiders. So you would go into your room in IMA, and you would see a painting, be it abstract, figurative, traditional, non-traditional, but you'd see works together. And my view about the architecture of IMA is that it creates a dialogue between works and a sort of exchange with the viewer, because the room structure allows you to juxtapose certain things. So those works are in dialogue. And our sort of, you know, informal surveys of audience reaction was extremely rich. And, you know, we didn't pretend they weren't outsider arts. You'd find that information out in a text or a wall panel or something, but we didn't put a big spotlight on something saying, well, outsider art, you have to look at this differently. And I think that is the responsibility of the mediators, of the distributors, of the curators, of the programmers, to be able to program work in such a way and juxtapose works where you create a sort of dialogical space which the visitor enters and participates in. And for me, the idea of citizenship is participation. And that can occur economically, socially, politically, but also culturally. And too many of our inherited models of institutional practice actually disavow that. Because what they tend to say is, you need us. It's a fantastic position for a curator to be in, or a director of a museum, or indeed a director of an art college to be in, because it gives you enormous power, because you're the gatekeeper. And I think it's time to change that model of that type of institutional process being, as it were, being like a temple.
Do you see that being changed anywhere?
There's a huge debate, and it's been running for some time in the museum and gallery world, and it informs the practice of a lot of contemporary artists now about how to challenge that, how to break it down. We have now a critical discourse around the idea of socially engaged art, of inclusive art, of situated practice. I would argue that's where the real dynamic in public art comes from, that instinct among artists that they need to reconnect with lived experience as it's lived, not as we would wish it would to be lived. And I mean, quite apart from the material opportunities that come with resourcing to create public artworks. But we've always had public art. But over the last 30 years, there's been a particular critical discourse and set of opportunities about public art, which align it, in my mind, with the artists recognizing, and increasingly curators and directors of museums, recognizing the need for that reconnection to take place again with lived experience, as opposed to the idea that it's a separated experience, that you have to go up the steps, quite literally, of the temple. It's no accident that for a long time museums looked like Greek temples. So did the Bank of England. So did banks. Banks and museums, architecturally, were modelled on Greek temples and Roman temples, because it was about power and authority. And the museum and the curator and the director had the power and authority. And you, as a general visitor, were disabled. You needed them. There is a lot of art practice now, and this process is part of that, where I believe people are enabled, both in terms of the practice, but also in terms of the communication process.
So we're talking about both the artist
and the
viewer.
Non-artist.
Yeah,
that's right.
Viewer.
Absolutely. This is a relationship between artist and non-artist, because it's always been, I would argue, if you look at art over the span of the human project, what its job was to create empathy. Seeing self in other, however other is defined. And it's not a question of defining it on the basis of ability or economic circumstances. Seeing self in other. And if you don't have empathy, you don't have a society.
Because empathy leads to respect, and respect is...
reciprocation.
Yeah.
We have institutional models, and I think even the models within our education system for art practice is based on the rhetorical model. Doesn't expect an answer. What I'm arguing about is a need, and it's underway, very, very slow to reform institutions that have been set in place, or institutional thinking which has been set in place. And it's not housed within a single institution. This goes right to the level of policy making and where the funding goes, and what the expectations are of that funding. Is a shift, as I said, from a reconnection of the aesthetic and ethical responsibilities, and a shift from the rhetorical model, both of art practice, of art understanding, and of institutional practice, to a reciprocal model. which expects dialogue, expects exchange, expects transaction.
But what's worrying is that, as we've just been talking about, we're not kind of in a media climate or social media, maybe perhaps there is more reciprocal culture arguing or whatever, but even social media wise, we seem to get into a bubble where we talk to
I remember one time in the 60s, a senior Tory politician, a lord, was talking to the Tory conference in England, and I was in the north, so it wasn't BBC. And he made a speech and he said at one point, when we think of the power, we, meaning the Tory party, when we think of the power of television to educate, aren't we glad it doesn't? And I think you could say the same thing about new technologies. That new technologies is an enormous potential. Yeah. And some of it's happening.
Yeah.
But the balance of investment in the new technologies is in favour of consumption. It's not about participation, although it pretends that it's giving you participation. It's actually a consumer model that has been projected heavily. And it's an incredibly efficient consumer model. But that's the dominant offer with new technologies. But the potential is extraordinary. We still don't quite know where that's taking us.
Yeah.
Lots of thinking about it at the moment, but we don't quite know where it's taking us.
Because the idea, just having read through your essay, and that idea of social capital and building social capital has been around. It's around for a long time.
It's a long time, yeah. No.
And it's an idea that people feel kind of warm and fuzzy about.
Yeah.
And they sort of latch on to the idea quite easy, but they don't really encourage it happening.
No,
it's
not invested in, because I think those people who hold power don't see it as advantageous to either themselves. I don't mean individuals being selfish about things, but their value system, their codes of values, or also they have so internalized the idea, and we hear this constantly, the way the world works now, you know, you can't buck the marketplace, and Reagan called it trickle-down economics, which is that if you facilitate an elite group to make profits, and the distortion of the society latterly with that is grotesque in terms of the lack of equality. But our political system still seems to be absolutely dedicated to the facilitation of profiteering and what I would call profit-taking as opposed to profit-making. Because profit-making could involve community profit, social profit, as well as fiscal profit. But what we have been facilitating, and it was very clear in the property crash and the making of the property crash, that we had been facilitating profit-taking. Society is fragmenting as we speak. And at the centre of this should be education, should be policy at all levels of education in terms of addressing this. Starting with the early years, I would even say starting preschool. And how you would do that, you'd need to sit down and start planning it. But we're not having anybody at the policy level, at the various highest level of policy, saying this is necessary. What they're saying is we've got to accommodate this, we've got to accommodate that. And behind it is this idea of trickle-down economics still. Our systems, our tax systems, our whole thing is built on that model of economics, which Thatcher and Reagan together worked out should be put in place in the 1980s. Deregulation, we know where that took us in terms of the banks. Privatisation of public services. The apparent celebration of individualism, but in fact is actually disempowering of the individual. It's quite an immoral position. I think it's immoral. I think this is about moral purpose, actually. And what kind of society we want. Do we want a whole society in which everybody has the chance and the means to participate and be a citizen? Mm. Not through certification, but through quality of participation. We don't have that. And I think that's the argument that argument falls to culture at the moment, because I don't think our party political system is capable of doing that. I don't think our economic system, as has been shown, is capable of creating empathy in that sense or creating that space. And I don't want to romanticise culture or the arts or artists, because many people in the art world don't buy my argument.
What would be the counter-argument to
Well, the counter-argument would be art speaks for itself. I remember one advisor to government in the 1990s in a public conference, very well-known figure, said, no, culture doesn't need state support. It bubbles up by itself.
What strikes me to do with the recession is that the thinking of people who are involved in this sector and who think like you do, their thinking has progressed along those lines, deepened, we'll say. Their conviction about the importance of art and citizenship and the interconnection between all the things that you're connecting up there for us very easily. Their thinking has deepened, and other positions have, on the other side, it would seem to me, have retrenched.
Have crystallised. They've recrystallised. You see, the recession was actually an amazing opportunity. You don't wish a recession to happen because it creates an opportunity. But I remember people ringing into Joe Duffy saying, nationalise the banks. Now, that's a debate that, prior to the recession, was on the outer fringes of, you know, the left. Nationalise the banks. People were ringing in and saying, well, the only thing to do here is nationalise the banks. Of course, we did nationalise the banks. But the opportunity has passed for that degree of change. We're still in a process of resetting. And the fundamental resetting is not just in levels of provision, you know, whether this amount of money goes to the arts or goes here or within the arts goes to this or that. The resetting is about expectations. And I think there's a deliberate resetting downwards of people's expectations for education, for culture, for health, for employment, and the nature and purpose of employment and so forth. And I think the expectations are being reduced.
Do you think an exhibition like this can kind of reclaim some of the ground?
This is the point. It's about, notwithstanding the fact that there's been a recrystallization of the old model. You see, I think our problem was that people kept talking about recovery, as if the old model broke, we need to repair the old model. I think I would have been arguing, and whatever fora I could make the argument, I'd say, we need a new model, folks. You know, now that's a very gross simplification of very complicated issues, but fundamentally, are we talking about a new model, or are we just talking about a bit of evil stick on the old model? Because the old model's broken. I mean, it's broken, and it might take a while for it to sort of run through, but it's broken. It's gone. The old model's gone. So the argument would be for a new model. So in the absence of that being adopted by policymakers, rather than us all walking away and getting tired, and the danger is you get burnt out, we need to up our game. And what's interesting about the comment you made about how good a quality the publication was, everything would be typeset, there'd be no handwritten stuff, no blue tack, stood for parity of esteem.
Exactly.
Yeah. The parity of esteem isn't about saying this is the same as this, it's about respect. And for what has been achieved.
One of the very interesting things for me that you've raised there is the responsibility, kind of awesome responsibility really, of the curators.
Yes.
Not only to put the work of the artists out there well, but also to kind of mediate with the public.
Exactly. This is why when we were, sorry to go back to the museum, but it's a very good model, I would argue. When we were due to recruit people who would carry out security functions, the term in the civil service is guardian. So the guys in the uniforms in the National Gallery are called guardians. That's their official title in the civil service pay structure. And I felt, well, that's absolutely the wrong model, because that gives you a brief, that gives you a particular brief in a particular position. And we negotiated a change of title for Emma, which was mediator. So the staff on the floor are mediators. And I think they still apply that. You know, if they're advertising, they apply for mediators who have security duties to fulfil, but their job is to engage the public in conversation. So that what's true of the person on the floor with the work every day is also true. The curator and director of a museum, the staff of the museum, have a huge responsibility because they stand between artists and non-artists. And if they actually behave like gatekeepers, you know, the priesthood in the temple, for instance, then I think that disempowers the public, and which is paradoxical because it's the public who are paying for the institution. It's a public institution. It's for the public. It's not for us. And whatever an individual artist may set out to do, it is certainly the job of publicly funded institutions to set about creating public value out of the experience of what artist A, artist B, designer, whatever, might do. Yeah. And whatever form it takes. So it's, again, I say in this, it's about purpose of that process, not the form that it takes. So if I'm talking to art students or artists or whatever, I always try to get them to focus on what their intention is. And if their intention is to make work for themselves, then stay in the studio. But if their intention is to communicate, and there's no artist that I've worked with worthy of the name, doesn't want to communicate, doesn't want to get the work out of the studio and into an exhibition space, exhibition as publishing, as distribution, as mediation of the ideas. So the mediating function of a publicly funded institution and the staff thereof is critical. And you see, for quite a long time, the pretense in that institutional inherited system was that the curator didn't exist. That these works had arrived on the wall and on the floor and those texts were unsigned. A very simple thing we did in the museum as well was any introductory text would have a curator's name at the bottom of it. Now, the curator has an opinion, and it's not that it's a less or a good opinion, but the sense is this idea of what this work is about comes from somebody who has done some research and spoken to the artists and so forth, but it comes from somebody. It's a view. And through the juxtaposition of other views by other exhibitions, other use of materials, whatever, you create a dialectic. And the visitor can enter the dialectic. So even the apparently most passive role for the non-artist, i.e. visiting an exhibition, that if it's constructed in a certain way, and this is why I was always a believer in the value of the Royal Hospital building, because its architecture insists that you juxtapose. You don't go into this big white box. But the rooms, you had to negotiate. You have to negotiate your journey and your pathway. And it might be directed, it might be undirected. You negotiate. So you're immediately in a sort of negotiation context. I mean, that was the thinking, I know.
But then it strikes me that what we're dealing with here in the exhibition are several different strands, some of which, I suppose, in terms of the work of these artists and their intention and their right to have a support, you know. I suppose some are more important to bring out at this time than others, you know. But it strikes me there's the intention of the artists themselves.
That's right.
There's the development of their potential, which seems to work very well through the support of
supportive studios. Yep.
There's their identity as artists. One of the lines that really spoke to me was, you know, what would your response be to what do you do? I go to a daycare centre every day. What do? I go to my studio to paint.
Yeah.
You know, how does that make a person feel?
Well, that's a very interesting bit of language. It's a completely different set of, or a completely different value accrues to the second statement as opposed to the first. I go to a daycare centre every day. I go to my studio to paint. The society values those two statements in completely different ways.
So this is my point exactly, that there's about the work of the artist, but what seems to me to be even more important is that mediation that the curators of this wonderful exhibition are doing in mediating to us very ignorant public with our very, it seems to me, very narrow set of judgments and values, which we assume to be the right ones because it's the ones we own.
Yeah.
But for them to mediate the deeper meaning here,
well,
society.
To create the opportunity, I mean, there's a phrase used somewhere in some bit of museum literature about this, from the casual visitor to the scholar. And I would have argued that any public institution, and we would have taken the line in Emma, that the programming should be such that you could enter at whatever level you needed to.
And Isn't there something, though, then as well about the whole concept of outsider art? These sort of labels, I suppose we have to put them on to understand concepts, but then we need to kind of break them as well.
We need to rename. One of the things that culture can do, and it's very necessary, is to name things.
And how do you think the work of the artist we're going to be looking at in Perceptions should be named? Is it outsider art, or is it...
Well, you see, I think the adoption of outsider art, when it was done, it was a big exhibition in the Hayward Gallery in 1979. It was the first time it was given that sort of status. And it was done by, I can't remember his name, but his surname was Musgrave, and a man called Roger Cardinal, who were art historians, and had started to collect some of this work and look at some of this work. Dubuffet in France had already established what he called l'art brut, brittle art. In other words, blunt, direct, and it influenced Dubuffet's own work as a major art historical figure. And so in the UK, they did this big exhibition in the Hayward, which was a groundbreaking exhibition. And then Monica Kinley and, I can't remember his first name, Musgrave, who were partners, set up the Kinley Musgrave Outsider Art Collection. And at that point, naming it as outsider art was naming it. Because up to that point in the UK, it had been art therapy. I mean, it had no status.
And but then it was the international. Tried to buy it. And then people want to own it, and then you're back into
then
this.
A market. A market realised there was an opportunity here.
The quality of
and
it.
In fact, some of the activities that would operate now under socially engaged art, not so much community art, but socially engaged practice or situated practice, if you actually look at some of the major international exhibitions, Documenta, Venice Biennale, they all, in the last 20 years, have tried to appropriate the dynamic and value and meaning in that work by including it in their big exhibitions, whereas prior to 20 years ago, they wouldn't have looked at it. It would have been very mainstream, very hierarchical.
Do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing because it means you're opening the door, because what you're starting to do is get access to power, because those institutional models and those programming models represent power and
so
validation.
So where is the resistance to... Obviously, when somebody tries to get some power, there's a counter...
Well, there's a status quo and there are vested interests who, whatever power there is to go around, they're having some of it. And they're not prepared necessarily to give it up or to see anybody encroaching on it. It's not even just economic, although there is an economic dimension to, you know, the field.
Yeah.
It's status and value and, you know, the hierarchy.
Yeah,
top of the tree...
Yeah.
And, you know, if this tree gets too crowded, we can't necessarily let all our stuff in. And if somebody else's own critical position or position of practice has been based on a particular grammar of skill and a syntax, which is supported by art critics and so forth and reviews, then along comes a form of work that doesn't obey any of those rules and is starting to be celebrated. That's quite a challenge. You know, if you're not a big enough person with an open mind, that's a pretty big challenge. And I've had direct experience of those conversations where it was very clear, very well-known artist, very threatened by the inclusive strategy in the museum, for instance, or indeed in other galleries, and would have rubbished it.
And isn't this where it comes back to education as well? Because it seems to me that there's always a fear amongst educators that while a certain amount of work in the disability sector is laudable, but
well, that's missionary work. You see,
this is
the curse of this whole sector, that it is regarded as missionary work, as good works, as a concession to something. When I actually think that there's an enormous amount of learning that is available.
Well, certainly
in
the music. I mean, that was what started my interest in it in the music sector, was that I kind of felt it was an issue for us as educators that we didn't actually know how to draw out the potential of people with a disability, intellectual or physical, and that we were the ones who needed to learn how to do that, but that it was tremendously rewarding for us in our own practice to do it. But what's different, I suppose, in the art area is that in music, a lot of it you were talking about performing practice, interpretive practice, where it's the creative process although having said that, in music it is through technology massively viable to start a creative process, but even we couldn't even do it at the performing level. Yeah. But then again, institutionally, there was a fear that this was going to encroach on traditional practice, and that would be very detrimental.
You see, my definition of culture is working definition is that it's what people make and do to add value to the quality of their lives.
And by extension to the lives of everyone else.
And they're, once you come into contact with it, absolutely. What happens then, of course, and the problems arise when you classify that. When you actually put a frame around it, and literally in art terms, it was a frame. It was you put a frame around it and say, but this is real art, and that's something else. That's therapy. That's just for you. That's not a communication. That has no potential to communicate to someone else.
So, in fact, sort of a heading there is, when is art therapy real art? I know immediately you get into what is real art.
Yeah.
But, you know...
But who frames it? It's the framing device. Have you heard about the Claude Glass?
No.
Claude Lorraine, landscape painter. And in the 18th century when, the European tour, wealthy families would do the European tour. And for that part of it where they went, a journey might take someone through the Alps, that woman were considered to be so vulnerable to the impact of the Alps, nature, an incredibly ordered universe. You think of the formal gardens and so forth, and I always think of Paris Court. You stand in Paris Court and you see this on the steps, and the gardens are layered down, but that ordered universe requires the wilderness still to be visible beyond, so that you know you're living in an ordered universe. And that was Capability Brown. That's art. That's landscape art. Yeah. He moved heaven and earth to create vistas. I mean, you can see it all around the great houses and so forth, the garden, the prospect and the vista. But for you to understand the value of your formal garden, you still needed to see the turf bogland beyond, because that was the wilderness.
And they thought that this would have too much of an impact on the fragile ladies.
And they thought that going through the Alps in particular, and it must have been based on actual experience, where people couldn't deal with raw nature. So what was created was the Claude Glass, which was a mirror with a frame around it and a handle. And the idea is that you'd be in your carriage, and if there was the Matterhorn or whatever was coming into view, you would look at it through the mirror. And you would move the mirror to compose the view. So you wouldn't be looking at nature. You'd be looking at the simulacrum, which is art. Yeah. As a control mechanism.
Astonishing.
As a control.
Concept.
It's a control mechanism. It's about ordering the universe in a certain way. That's why I mentioned, that's why I talk about Newtonian physics and the Enlightenment and so forth. All of that is rolled into our culture. Because our culture is how we see things. And why we see that as less is because we're doing a Claude Glass operation on art and saying this is what has value. This is what I can deal with, is actually what you're saying. I can't deal with this stuff beyond. I can't deal with psychotic art. I can't deal with, all the names that are put on it, which are all disadvantages and are intended to lessen it. None of this is accidental. That's the other point I would make, because, power is never given up easily. At some point, of course, from 1979, that show that took place in the Hayward, to now, it's quite different. The discourse is quite different. The opportunities are different. Look at the quality of that publication, the quality of the exhibition, the fact that it's happening. That documentary was on television as well, again, under the outsider art. But there is another paradigm shift that needs to take place in this period, which is, I characterise it as them, not us. This isn't about the arts sector being healthy. This is about the society being healthy and the role of the arts within that.